How's it going, Randy?
Jim, are you ever going to get tired of introducing the show that way? We've done like three dozen episodes or something now.
Probably not. I mean, because how else am I going to greet
Well,
my friend Randy? What awesome thing would you like to talk about today, Randy?
you brought this topic to the table, and I thought it was really nice a topic to get into because we haven't talked about string theory yet, and Leonard Susskind has written a couple of he's got a lecture in a paper that you gave me about the anthropic landscape of string theory, which is a particularly interesting feature of modern cosmology. So I thought it'd be fun to talk about that and see where it leads us.
I've seen these papers wander past in a couple of different places. Most recently, I think I was reading something called Cosmic Update, which is from the Multiversal Journeys series. So it's the same series that's published by Springer group called Multiversal Journeys, and they're the ones who published that book with Itzhak Barz talking about his 2D theory. I picked up this other book, and this one was about just different sort of things going on with how the universe is supposed to work. And I saw these anthropic landscape papers from Leonard Susskind for the third or fourth time and thought maybe we'd want to talk about them. Knowing that you've asked in the past to talk about string theory, and we like to talk about the vacuum at some point to get an idea about what that really is, that's really what he's talking about in this particular case, is what is the vacuum like?
Yeah, and he's a brilliant guy. He's got a bunch of lectures on YouTube, and I remember that he won a debate with Stephen Hawking about information being lost in black holes. It turns out that it's not lost, and that yielded a holographic universe concept, which apparently has gained some traction. So he's a really wonderful, brilliant mind, and so it's good to go over some of his work. But I have to say, I tend to favor a little bit more Lee Smolin's take on string theory. He's a little bit more my style of a physicist, like a little more conservative in his willingness to take big leaps, and a little more skeptical of the validity of string theory, which, the thing that I really love about string theory is that it gets us talking about some really big questions in physics, testing proving ground, I guess, for the really big philosophical ideas in physics. And one of the things that I think he's saying in these papers, maybe you should describe it, talk a little bit about the anthropic landscape and what it means in this context.
The anthropic landscape, I mean, the landscape, I guess, is the way to look at it originally, is this idea that in string theory, there are multiple minima in the potential, whatever this potential is, that sort of describe the energy of the vacuum. There is a place sort of in the center that is a continuum of solutions that has no vacuum energy, has no cosmological constant, is the way that Susskind was talking about this. And then radiating out from that, there's a much smaller infinity, a countable infinity of little individual local minima, where at each of these local minima, there's a cosmological constant, and there's some sort of field that goes along with it.
There was something like 10 to the 500th superstring vacuous solutions that have, I think, zero energy. Was that what you got out of that paper?
I think that was another paper. I think the one that actually said 10 to the 500th was the popular article from Science from 2006. And that was going back to a paper that Susskind references by a bunch of people whose names aren't in front of me right now. And that particular paper tried to figure out things about how many of these things there are. So maybe there aren't a countable infinity. Maybe there are only 10 to the 500th of these different vacua. But these are the ones that have a cosmological constant. The ones in the center that Susskind is saying the moduli space of supersymmetric vacua, I think from what he was talking about, is that there's a continuum that's sort of nailed down by the five classic sorts of superstring theory. And that basically means that you take those five different types and you can sort of mix and match and get another superstring theory. Those all have the zero cosmological constant. It's these other ones, the non-zero ones, that are the 10 to the 500th. So maybe that's not a countable infinity. Maybe that's just really close to being, that's not even really close to being a countable infinity. That's just really, really big.
But it seems to me that he's describing this idea is that all of these different solutions are physically real and manifest somewhere throughout the apparently infinite cosmos. Is that right?
Yeah, so the idea is that we can tunnel into any one of those at any point. And in fact, that we already have tunneled into one of those because we see a positive cosmological constant. So because we see a positive cosmological constant, we're in one of these other sort of vacua.
Non-supersymmetric vacua, right.
And since we're in one of those things, we see the kind of world that we see. At some point, we were in one of the supersymmetric vacua states. And later on, we're going to have to fall back into one of those supersymmetric vacua states. But for the meantime, we have the sort of world we live in.
Okay, but one of the things that he brought up was that there's a boundary, there's a hill of potential around these minima, right?
Yeah, so it's sort of talking about these membrane-like domain walls. I think that's in the configuration space, not in real space. That's just saying that the values of whatever constants you need the values for each one of these different minima, the values for those constants that are describing how space is folded in on itself, those change, but if you change them a little bit from where they are right now in our universe, then you know, they just go to a place where you have a higher energy, a higher vacuum energy, and they'll fall back to where we are now, like they would with any sort of potential idea. But there is a possibility that they'll tunnel through from one end to another, from one minima to another minimum, and then everything will change. Basically, the way space folds in on itself changes, and you get a different set of constants and a different set of particles and things like that.
Well, the problem that I have with this idea, in this idea that all of these various solutions to string theory are physically represented in the universe, and that we're in a small patch that happens to be habitable because the energy is low enough to that the galaxies could form and all that kind of stuff. The problem that I have with that is when we look out into the universe, it seems like we're getting the same basic physics from every remote region that we can observe. And that's a pretty big piece. I mean, you know, we're observing something like, what is the radius of the observable universe? I think it's something like 50 billion light years. So we don't see any new physics in any of those regions. And why would the observable universe coincide perfectly with a domain that's got a constant vacuum energy throughout that volume? Like I thought that the observable universe is defined by the expansion of our universe, and so there's sort of like an event horizon that we can't see past. You know, why would that coincide with a specific domain? They should be sort of unrelated. So if there were a bunch of patchwork physical changes to the vacuum, then we should be able to observe some patch somewhere doing something, you know, differently, maybe giving us different wavelengths of light coming off of, you know, hydrogen fusion and that kind of thing, right?
But I think one of the things he was talking about, Susskind spent a lot of time talking about the distinction between the inside and the outside of the solutions and things like that.
Right. He talked a lot about how there was no global physical model for the whole picture, but within each regime, there would be a consistent physics that we could understand.
Yeah, and so somewhere in there, he was showing that from the inside, what do you call it, the causal patch. So from the causal patch that we're in, there is an event horizon that would look like what we see as the limit of the observable universe.
Yeah, but why would it coincide so perfectly with a sphere? I don't know, it just seems odd that, you know, it would look spherical. Like if the universe really was a patchwork of these different causal domains, then wouldn't one be a little closer on one side, or wouldn't it be a patch somewhere so that the universe wouldn't be this perfect sphere?
Probably relativistically, it all ends up looking like a sphere. You know, the light that's coming from every direction is going to basically come from just as far away.
Okay. Is he saying in this model that if you go far enough that you should enter into a different causal domain? I mean, I thought the idea was that all of these different solutions to superstring, at least the stable ones, are physically real somewhere.
he didn't say that they're all real. I think he's saying that they're all possible and they all can happen. I don't recall that he said that they all actually happen. He did care a lot about probabilities of different configurations happening, but it didn't sound to me like he was saying that all of them exist somewhere, although if you're looking at things in some sort of infinite universe model, they would, because they're only like 10 to the 500th of them, and compared to infinity, that's chump change. That particular statement I don't recall. So I don't know how often they're going to interfere with each other. It sounded like that any particular one, it's going to have that same accelerated expansion inside of it, so that if you're inside of it, you're never actually going to see a spot where something bad happens. I'm a little bit confused about nucleation, how it happens and why it happens, where it can happen, how long it takes to happen. So, for example, I was reading this afternoon, and I was wondering, so while this is nucleating, so if we have this little bubble universe nucleating at some spot, how does that propagate along the vacua, right? How does that propagate along the strings? How is it that got a domain of a different kind of wrapping for the strings showing up at some spot? How does that expand? How does that go from one string to another, right? Because basically what you're saying is you're changing the geometry that the string can vibrate in. And so how does that propagate? I don't understand how that would work. So I don't really understand how the nucleation occurs. I can understand it a little bit better if they're all happening from that continuum and they're bubbling up into you have a big patch that tunnels up. But I don't really understand what's happening if you're actually got nucleation sites inside of the entire spacetime.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, if that was happening inside of our universe, then you'd think there would be some indication of that. Because he does talk about this bubble process where, you know, the bubbles of different vacua energies appear within a universe like our own, for example. Like they're happening within each other, according to this model. But I guess if they're propagating, if that change is happening at the speed of light radially, then you wouldn't be able to observe it until it had already happened? Or I guess you'd suddenly be within it and not know it?
Yeah, if you're thinking about this anthropically, if you're thinking about this as a human observer can actually see, if it's propagating at the speed of light, then we don't know about it until it happens. You're absolutely right about that. There's no way for us to figure out that it's actually happening. But I'm not really sure what happens to us as individuals if all the laws of physics change while we're trying to look through a telescope. I have a strong feeling that if all the laws of physics change, then all of a sudden there aren't very many of us left.
Maybe the changes are small enough that they wouldn't immediately disintegrate us.
Well, I mean, if they're of the kind where they can not only change lambda, not only change the cosmological constant, but also change the masses of all the elementary particles, which is what he was talking about.
Yeah, that's kind of terrifying.
Things could be very, very bad.
Like, oh, I'm a black hole.
So we might not get the opportunity to know that if it happens.
Okay.
But that is a good point that you have there. I mean, the reason why we might not see it is because anytime you could see something like that happening, it's at more or less the time that it's happening to you.
Yeah, that's a terrifying thought. I remember reading somewhere an idea that perhaps our universe is in a energized state, and I guess with a positive cosmological constant, that's the case, which it would mean that there's a non-zero probability that at any given moment, at any given place in space-time, that space could change completely, reach, I guess, a zero energy state, and alter the laws of physics within there, if there are any laws of physics within it, and that would expand out at the speed of light and basically wipe out the universe. Like, the idea was that our universe is like an excitation in a field. It's just a temporary fluctuation, and it could relax to basically nothingness.
Yeah, and that's exactly what this is saying. And with that same implication is that since we're in an excited state, that we will go from this de Sitter universe that we're in right now at some point into a FRW universe. And then, you know, things are a little bit different. Exactly how different, I don't know, but I guess that would be a supersymmetric state. So all of a sudden we'd have to worry about our leptons and our quarks and our xenos and higgsenos and stuff like that.
And at the very least, if you go from a positive cosmological constant down to a zero cosmological constant, then suddenly you're going to have a situation where gravity is going to collapse the whole universe, right?
Isn't the zero cosmological constant solution the one where you never actually come back? right? So then Susskind said if you go to a negative cosmological constant, then all of a sudden you get the contraction. But he also said that he doesn't know if that's really possible in the string theory. So you could go from one end to the other end, but I think if you're going to do that, first you have to pop in and pop out and stuff like that. A lot of it is a little unclear. I think a lot of it's unclear because nobody really has any idea, even in the theoretical context, about what would really happen.
I guess one of the problems that I have with string theory is that I don't see any evidence that there are higher dimensions, which is a huge thing. And I don't see any evidence that the vacua solutions tell us anything about the observable universe. So I feel like there's not really any empirical reason to embrace string theory.
As I understand it, string theory's made some progress here and there. I'm not completely sure that there's anything that forces you to believe that string theory is the way to go. But it is an interesting thing that the string theory has the ability to make a lot of these predictions if you get those constants right. There are a couple of problems. One is, in general, you got all these constants to think about, to play with. So if you have a bunch of constants to play with and you have some clever physicists, they'll be able to figure out a way to match, you know, this theory with what they see. And the sort of other problem is the fact that, or as I understand it, the fact that this all requires a universal background, right? It's not a relativistic background, but a universal background. There has to be some preferred frame for all the string theory stuff to work. Well, I got that from reading Smolin's book. So that's what he says. That's not what I say because I don't understand it.
I remember he was also saying, though, that they don't have a global theory for how this landscape works, that they could look at the content of any causal domain and make sense of that, but they have no idea how they're kind of stitched together and how the big picture works, and that if there is a way for them to all work together, then you'd have to dispense with like one of three quantum principles that are kind of sacred.
He goes into a lot of detail about that distinction between the global and the local. So there's this global way of looking at things, which is more or less this quantum mechanical way of looking at it. And then there's this causal patch, which is the way you look at it. So this is his complementarity. So he's saying we've got two different ways to look at any given situation. This exterior way, which is the quantum description, which is a little more like, say, an Everett wave function. Then you just have this quantum mechanical state for the universe. And then you have this interior causal patch, this way that you're looking at things. And that's more or less the physics. That's like the general relativity and all that other stuff. What he's saying is that you can't have a description that covers both of these things at the same time. So you can cover everything using string theory. You can cover everything using general relativity and the normal physics that we use in day-to-day life. But you can't mix and match. You can't mix them together and get something useful. If, he says, you were able to do that, you'd violate something. You'd violate the equivalence principle, the quantum mechanics, or the no-cloning theorem. And he thinks probably that if you violated one of them, the best one to violate would be the no-cloning theorem.
Yeah, that idea. I think the reason he thinks that is because when he won his bet with Stephen Hawking, it was because the no-cloning theorem had been, in a sense, violated on a black hole because the model for a black hole was that the information that falls into the black hole is somehow encoded on the surface, and that the object inside is somehow like a holographic projection of what's encoded on the surface. So there was kind of duplication of the information in that scenario. So that's probably why he favors that for a cosmological explanation, you know. He expanded that idea to describe the whole universe and to look at the event horizon at, you know, the observable boundary of our universe as the surface of the black hole. And in that idea, like, we're the projection, we're the hologram of the information on the surface. But on the other hand, it's really hard to fathom because that isn't really a physical boundary. Like, the limit of the observable universe is just the region where space-time expansion between us and that point exceeds the speed of light. So it's not really a physical boundary in the same sense that a black hole has a physical boundary when seen at a distance, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you were to look at that spot where the world hasn't evolved yet to that being that distance, right? If you look at that spot, the distance to the edge of the universe, and you have this sort of bubble guy going on, if you have this bubble thing happening, that would be the edge of the bubble as it expands out from its nucleation. So at least in this case, in this sense, that does make some sense why we'd be sort of inside of the black hole.
But it seems to me that in that case, for there to be a spherical boundary at a finite distance, then that would put us right in the middle of the universe again, because we see the same radius all around us, right?
I'm not sure. I think maybe relativistically you can get away with that. But maybe you're right. I can't say it makes that much sense to me that I can find a real good way to talk about it. But I think that probably there's some way that, I'm sure there's some way that Seskin would say, you know, you did this, 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 and it, now it all makes sense.
Well, I'm not so sure. You may be in good company, because Frank Wilczek was saying in that article that there's still a lot of unresolved issues with the landscape theory. Maybe that kind of stuff is one of those.
I think that's a larger issue than just the landscape theory. Maybe it also works with the landscape theory, but I can see that there are many, many issues with this idea of the landscape. But, I mean, that's just, there are just a lot of things that are sort of very wishy-washy in the way they talk about this. And a lot of it seems to be just a good way to, I shouldn't say that. a lot of it seems to be a way to say, you know, maybe we don't have to just figure out what these physical constants really are. Maybe they're all viable, and we just happen to not be in a place where these constants have these different values, right? We happen to be in this place where the constants all have values that are amenable to having human life.
Well, and that's where you've put your finger on the main debate, I guess, about these papers and this in general, is the whole argument about the anthropic principle. You know, are we really going to abandon sort of the kind of rigorous, mechanistic, deterministic style of physics of the last few centuries and just throw our hands up and say, well, all of these different possibilities exist, all 10 to the 500 or 10 to 1,000 varieties of possible vacuous solutions, and we just happen to be on a patch that is favorable to life, which is why we're observing the one we do.
And that could be. There's some viability to that. That should never be the end of things. I mean, that might get us to a spot where we're ready to start investigating, but I don't think it would get us very much farther. It's sort of like the difference between, say, the Lyman series and the Bohr model. You know, it's nice that you have a nice numerical description of the emission lines of an atom, but that doesn't really tell you about what's happening in the atom. Then you get to the Bohr model, you get at least a sort of physical picture, and then we get real quantum mechanics. And we have a real description of the atom. I mean, that's where everything has to end up in the long run. But maybe as a first step, it's not such a bad idea.
I don't know. I find myself skeptical of it because I feel like string theory was like, let's invent as many degrees of freedom as we need in order to model pretty much everything that could possibly happen and explain all those different variety of physical phenomena, including gravity. And as a result of inventing all these extra degrees of freedom, they end up with a smorgasbord of potential physical solutions, which is mind-boggling. And now they want us to believe that that whole smorgasbord is real and that we just happen to be on a very convenient piece of it. It's like that line of thinking is, just strikes me as dubious.
It's always been a problem. I mean, it shows up over and over again, but it's still something that even they talked about in my astrophysics class as an undergraduate. So people have been talking about it for a very, very long time. You know, I think it's no more than a useful tool at most points, even if Steven Weinberg can predict, you know, that dark energy is going to have approximately this value using it. I'm not sure how useful that prediction is. If the principle is really that useful, then it should always work. Or at least, you know, you should be able to document the different times people have used it in a reasonable manner and show that it's worked at a very reasonable rate. One person making an educated guess based on something like that probably doesn't really help.
Yeah, Leonard Susskind wrote that entire other paper that we read, Supersymmetry Breaking and the Anthropic Principle, in response to sort of a counterpoint against the anthropic principle, where Banks, Dine, and Gorbatov said that if the anthropic principle was right, then why does the proton have such a huge lifetime?
Yeah, and I think these are the same guys who went through and characterized the landscape. So it's an important group to have that come out of. You know, they showed there that in an anthropically acceptable landscape, sites have to have the proton last for less than or around 10 to the 17th years. I don't know how precise that actually is, but it shouldn't be over 10 to the 17th years. Whereas, of course, we only have a lower bound on the lifetime of the proton in the universe. As far as we know, it's going to stay around forever.
Right. The lower bound was 10 to the 32 years. So that's almost, you know, another, what is that, 15 orders of magnitude greater.
And that's pretty big for, even for a theorist.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting thing. So both Susskind and some other groups apparently have gone through and found ways around that, saying that they've made a decision about what should happen with certain values, that maybe something else should have happened instead. But it seems to me that if you're going to try to determine whether or not the anthropic principle is useful, you have to make a catalog of all the possible predictions that it would make and actually see if they've come true.
Well, that would be an interesting paper to read. I'd like to hear about that.
It might be more than a paper. Just think about all the things that we don't know and all the different theories that are out there. You wouldn't use it just for string theory. You'd have to look at it in all different sorts of places to see how reasonable it actually is.
One of the gems that came up in this supersymmetry breaking paper, he said that increasing the Higgs expectation value and keeping everything else fixed increased the strength of gravity, making stars and galaxies in the universe evolve much faster. That's fascinating. I didn't realize that there was a connection to the strength of gravity with the Higgs expectation value like that. He also said that alternatively, you could try to keep particle masses fixed by decreasing the Yukawa couplings. So there's another mechanism there for mass and gravity that I've never heard discussed before. I'm kind of fascinated with that because I love the idea of being able to somehow technologically modify the Higgs expectation value in a region of space to modify the strength of gravity.
He said a little bit about this, and I think that was sort of saying that these are different places where the anthropic principle could be used. I mean, it would be interesting to take a peek at some of those references and see what they actually say, assuming those are places where he had references.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing any references in those comments, but I'd like to learn more about that, because that's a connection between general relativity and quantum mechanics that I was unaware of. So when people talked about the discovery of the Higgs boson, they were very quick to explain that this doesn't directly relate to gravity, and yet here's a pathway where at least the Higgs expectation value does have a pathway to manipulating gravity. So I'm always intrigued where there's a little indication that the two theories are directly linked to each other, you know?
Yeah, that would be interesting to see exactly how that works. Although I looked at the paper and I didn't see any references to that particular subject. Figuring out how to get superstring to gravity reference will be fun, especially if we want one that isn't too crazy as far as the math is concerned.
Yeah, it's some pretty deep quantum mechanics stuff. You've got much better grasp of the operators and everything in that regime than I do. What else came up in this paper that was interesting? I liked what you said before about wondering how a shift would happen in a causal patch. In order for that to propagate, the fabric of space-time itself, as generated by the hyperdimensional looping knotting of these strings, would have to somehow change, like, in a wave front at the surface of this expanding bubble, and that just seems really bizarre and unlikely.
It seems bizarre and unlikely for a couple of reasons, right? One is we don't usually think of it that way. We don't think of the universe as having different physics in different patches. I think it seems a little more bizarre and unlikely when you're saying, well, what's happening is somehow we're changing the way these strings oscillate. So he was talking about these, you know, seven tori, right? Or the seven-dimensional toruses, that the strings are constrained to vibrate in, and basically what you're doing in these different regions in the landscape, I kind of get the idea that, maybe I'm wrong about this, but is you're changing those tori, and so you're changing the radius or whatever it is of these seven different dimensions, or I guess they're more. You're changing the radii of these seven different tori, and then your strings have to vibrate differently in each one of these different regions. So exactly what's happening?
Yeah, and why would it be uniform from one point to another in the first place?
If it can change, why is it not uniform? What is the force that would be coupling them? So if you were to think of other things that would have domains, if you'd look at a magnet or something like that, there is literally a force between unpaired electrons in each atom, keeping the spins aligned so that you end up with a net magnetic moment in a domain. That's the exchange force. But what is the analog to that force in the vacuum? Why would one little patch of vacuum care about the way the other little patch of vacuum is forcing the strings to vibrate? And then how would you change it? It's a completely different way of looking at that vacuum.
Yeah, it is. He talks about supermoduli space, and he seems to be describing those as like as an analogy to a field. So is that the kind of connections that you're talking about?
Well, no. The supermoduli space, I don't think, is a space that you look at as space. A supermoduli space is abstract space, like a mathematical space, that has however many dimensions as they have constants in string theory. And so that space is just the different values of each one of those constants. And the supermoduli space is this region where you have supersymmetric vacua, which again forms a continuum. And the rest of that space, outside of that continuum area, then you have these other regions or these other spots where you have the positive cosmological constant. And those also have different values for all of the different things in the string theory, but they don't end up being supersymmetric.
I guess he never talked about the nitty-gritty of how these hyperdimensional topologies of like that 7 torus can be like linked together and alter in a, like a uniform wave way.
No, he doesn't talk about anything like that. But that's in a more normal kind of space than moduli space. That's just in this sort of compactified region where you have these dimensions folding in on each other plus the normal 3+1 dimensions that we're used to. So those are a little closer to things that we normally think about. The only problem is they're compactified, and I don't really understand the reason why traveling from one point to another in the universe or with two things next to each other, why they would shift from one of these sets of dimensions, one of these sets of radii, to another set of radii. Other people probably do, because, you know, they do the string theory all the time. I don't, so I have no idea what's going on.
He talked about membrane tension, and he talked about 2D membranes and analogs, and he mentioned electrons and positrons as somehow manifestations of this membrane.
That was an analogy. What he was trying to say is that you're saying, okay, we have a one-dimensional electric field. If you have a one-dimensional electric field, then if you have more electrons, then you have more field, basically. And so every time you put an electron into that region, you get a larger field. And that's sort of what's happening, is that there's something so that when you put one into our universe, and I've forgotten exactly what that is, that will excite the region. And so you get a higher potential and you have a different field in each one of these non-supersymmetric states. So the thing that you're adding in, which goes into the cosmological constant in the different supersymmetric states, that goes into the vacuum energy or whatever it's going to be, that's going to be equivalent to the electron or positron, and that changes the field value for each one of these different states, each one of these different vacua. That's what he's saying is happening when you switch from one vacuum to another vacuum.
Yeah, he was saying that this membrane tension was related to the domain wall between these two different vacua. And I was just trying to figure out, like, could you cross from one to the next?
Well, that's what the tunneling is.
Well, I thought the tunneling was just like a change in energy state for the underlying space, right?
But the domain wall is this region. Well, I guess he has two places where there's a domain wall. But I think that he had some idea that there was a wall around the individual vacua. And that was a region between two minima where you have a maximum in between. I mean, and that's all it was. And when you go to an infinite potential, that goes down to zero. And you go to zero potential, that goes to infinity. And you have that metastable state that's sitting there just waiting for anything to come by and push it over. Like if you had a bar under tension, if you're pushing on a bar and it's compressed a little bit, it doesn't really like being that way. But if you don't give it any reason to zip from one end to another, it's just going to stay compressed. That's in a metastable state. That would be like our universe is sort of like that compressed bar. And then anything that happens, anything that comes by that can knock us out of that state, all of a sudden that bar will pop out from one side or the other and buckle. So you get a little bit of an idea of a kind of buckling thing happening at any particular energy that will push you out of that metastable state that we're in and could disappear at any moment.
Can you think of that domain wall as like a physical wall? I mean, I'm imagining that In Star Trek, there was the edge of the galaxy thing they had to pass through. It was like a field of energy.
So the other way to think about that wall could be something like that, because you have these different nucleations. And that front that's pushing out the nucleation, that I can see as being something like what you're thinking of. I think it's harder to think about that in terms of the different vacua, which is the other place he used that, where he was saying in between the different things, there's some sort of barrier. And I think that's what he was really talking about, was this sort of barrier between the two different states, or the many different states. The thing is that barrier is now a funny looking thing. It's not the simple thing that you'd think of as a barrier in one dimension, because it's in a lot of dimensions.
Oh, that's right, because that membrane tension would be, I guess, in the knots of the strings that create the space-time field?
Oh, I have no idea. That's way past what I understand about all this.
I remember, maybe the reason Isaac Barrs was with that publisher is because he was writing papers on these, on the, like, 11-dimensional string theory and brain theory for a long time. I used to see his papers at the graduate physics department of USC. And the mathematics was unbelievably complicated. So maybe that's why, because he was originally a string theorist. And I guess he still is an expert in it, because he worked so hard on it. But I kind of feel like he's changed directions.
Looks a little bit like he's doing some more interesting things. I shouldn't say it that way. But he's really branched out into a lot of different things if you look at his webpage.
I love the idea of two-time physics, because why are we so ready to accept, you know, 11 dimensions of space, or 9 dimensions of space, something in between, and we always have one time dimension. Why not have additional dimensions of time as well?
If you're reading Isaac Barrs, then he's saying, you know, most of the time when you try putting that extra time dimension in there, you get a lot of ghosts.
Except for that six-dimensional model they came up with a certain gauge constraint, right?
Yeah, so he started with the gauge constraint and ended up with that 4 plus 2 instead of a 3 plus 1 model of the universe. And that was perfectly fine. So he started with a principle that should not do anything bad, and it didn't do anything bad, and so he was happy. But most of the time when people have been doing this, they just added on that second time dimension. And when they just added on that second time dimension, it didn't do good things. So that's probably the reason why they only use one dimension of time most of the time.
Because you can add space dimensions without causing problems. You can wrap them all up into little balls, but you can't do that with the time dimension.
I don't know if you can do that with the time dimension. Maybe people haven't been able to do that with the time dimension. With Barr's theory, of that extra space and that extra time are both macroscopic. So that's a little bit different from any of these compactified dimensions.
Yeah, I wonder if it's possible to wrap up time into these little objects. I don't know.
Probably is, but I don't know what it would do. Probably people have tried it, probably did some crazy thing, which would make them a lot of fun to discuss. I'm not sure how many people actually do work on it.
What is the deal with M-brain theory? It seems like they're doing some really exotic topologies, like by wrapping 5 brains the same way the fluxes in the 4 forms are wrapped on internal 3 cycles. Leaves 2-dimensional membranes in 3+1 dimensions. What the hell is going on there?
I have no idea. You know, that's stuff you'd have to go a little more deeply into than, you know, a couple of lines in a paper.
It sounds like he's talking about the strings all linking together in a way that creates like a planar surface in a higher dimension, which then has its own properties of folding and surface tension and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's sort of the idea I get behind brain theory. That's sort of the idea behind M theory is something like that.
So the brains are compactified, just like the strings are.
Yeah, they're still compactified. They're still doing the same thing. They just have some more degrees of freedom, I think.
Well, he did point out in this paper that De Sitter space doesn't fit well with string theory.
There was somebody who was talking a lot about that, and he described those arguments. So yeah, I mean, it looks like the fact that the De Sitter space has a finite entropy makes it very difficult to have a reasonable energy spectrum. The big problem ends up being that your eternal De Sitter space makes it impossible to have quantum gravity, or vice versa. Basically, it has something to do with, you know, in string theory, only S-matrix elements are rigorously defined objects. If you have a thermal background, then you can't have an S-matrix element. And in that case, you don't have a cosmological constant. If you start off saying, I want a De Sitter space, but you have to have a De Sitter space with no cosmological constant, then you're screwed.
That seems like a big problem.
That makes it difficult to do all of these things. I mean, that's just a couple of these problems. I mean, as far as problems for string theory are concerned, I think people can probably find some reasonable ways around it. But, you know, I think it's a problem, but I don't think it's the kind of problem that is going to keep people awake at night.
Okay. Isn't there a subclass of string theories that can be reasonably considered to model the reality that we observe?
I think there's probably a very large class of those. I think that's the problem is I think there are a lot of string theories, basically, that can model most of what we observe. If there were none of them, then nobody'd care. If there were only a few of them, we'd know names for each one, right? Just like they used to have names for the different string theories at the very beginning.
When there was like five different versions, right?
Yeah, with exciting names like type 1, type 2A, type 2B. So if there were a small number, we'd probably know what all of those were. The problem has been around for a very long time, is that there are a lot of different sets of values that could possibly work. And it's really hard to pin down which ones exactly would show everything to be the way we measure it to be. That's one of the things that gets people annoyed about string theory. You can ask a string theorist whether that's fair. I think that's what I've heard mostly from people who don't like string theory very much, is that, you know, basically it's not very predictive because you've got a huge variety of possibilities. And no matter what anybody measures, you still end up with a huge variety of possibilities on the order of a continuum.
Right. I mean, it's basically unfalsifiable because there's quadrillions of string theories for every possible experimental observation.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just one of the things people don't like about string theory. It's something they just have to deal with if that's what they're planning on working on.
Well, all right. I guess that's all the major questions that I had. Was there anything else you wanted to bring up?
No, I think we've hit just about everything. So I think we've got our first string theory talk in. And since you also wanted to talk about vacua and general relativity, I think this worked out pretty okay. So I'm good with it. You're good with it. Any final thoughts?
I love this quote from Steven Weinberg because he came up when he made the prediction of the magnitude of the cosmological constant based on the anthropic principle. And I remember this quote that he said that dark energy is the central problem for physics. It's been the bone in our throat for a long time. That certainly seemed to be true in this paper, because it seems like dark energy and superstring theory are very hard to reconcile. It reminds me of one of the things that I love about the great minds in physics is they're very ready to admit where the problems are. I love the brightest minds recognize the open questions more readily than everybody else. You know, like so much you see so people defending the existing hierarchy, and the people at the top of that hierarchy are actually, you know, looking at really big problems and really trying to solve them, you know. It's a different mentality, but I really respect it. Steven Weinberg keeps coming up. And he got the Nobel Prize for unifying electromagnetism with the weak force. So anyway, yeah, that was just a little note that I had in there. So thanks for bringing this up. This is a lot of fun. We didn't really get too much into the bizarre properties of strings and brains and fluxes and handles and the weirdness of trying to create a space-time field using one-dimensional strings in higher dimensions, but there's plenty of time for that in the years ahead.
Yeah, I don't think string theory is going away anytime soon. All right, well, thank you very much, Randy.
Thank you, Jim. You have a wonderful night.
You bet. You too. Bye now.
Bye, everyone.